Well, we've been looking at the Arab, Israeli, and now the Islamic fights with each other, if you will. And I want to spend a little time this evening talking about Muhammad's apologist and his life. I don't want to go into great detail about that because what he is of less importance to us in detail than the bigger scope of how this war, if you will, that's been going on since early Genesis, that's been laid out for us, how this has developed and how he was instrumental in really throwing gas on the fire, so to speak. The modern Muslim apologists have a tendency to rewrite history. They don't look at the historical narrative that is in existence. They view him as being sinless. So anything that anybody says, regardless if it's true or not, they say, we reject that. He was sinless, so he couldn't have done that. They reject if you bring out passages in their Quran, in the Hadith, in their own writings. Oh, that's not true. That can't be true. But the Quran's true. And you say, wait a minute, how can the Quran be true and we're saying this and you're saying that can't be true? Well, Muhammad's sinless. They did circular reasoning and no logic. They have a tendency to rewrite history, especially in today's generation. I mean, a generation ago, even 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they wouldn't have been doing this. Boy, they are now. They're doing it in mass. And what they do is basically restate history, and then they teach others that, and these people never look back to see what really was written. We see similar things happening in Christianity. I've been going on the radio about the four big Christian cults that arose in the 1800s, and they just basically denied a lot of the authority of Christ, who he was, and what the Bible says. They got no basis for doing it, but they deceive many, many people. And deception is not something new. Christ said to the Pharisees, you guys are deceiving the people that are here. And here's what he said, Matthew 23:13. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for ye neither go in yourself, nor suffer ye them that are entering to go in. In other words, you guys aren't going in, and you're steering other people out of it. Well, the same thing happens today with the Muslim apologists. They don't want people to know what really happened, what Islam is really about. So they've got this guise, so to speak, that it's a peaceful religion. The problem that we're facing is the age-old problem that the adversary, the prince of the power of this world, that we call Satan, has blinded the people that don't believe. Look what the Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4:4. In whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. So, in fact, these writers who have engaged the Muslims on this subject find that they just won't even listen to them. They just won't even listen to them. Now, I've heard stories of Jewish people being offered Christ, and when somebody starts talking about Christ, they just start yelling and close their ears and move away. This is what the Islamists do. They don't want to hear anything that's contrary to what they've been taught. And what they're learning is just something that is from this generation. It's not something that's been going on, something that's been taught as a long time, you know, for a long time. Now, remember, they view now Muhammad as being sinless. One of the authors that I've quoted explicitly is Robert Morey. And he says, Muslim theologians begin by assuming that their beliefs are true. Thus, they assume that they do not have to prove anything. But they have it backwards. They have the burden of proof to demonstrate that Muhammad was a true prophet, not just another false prophet. You see, the historical evidence says this is what he did. This is who he was. This is how he acted. This is what he started. And when that's the data that we have, somebody that's going to come and say something contrary to that has got to produce the evidence that's contrary to it. That's the logical reason, a reasonable way of arguing a position. You see that in the science of evidence. It's taught in first-year law school. How is evidence sifted out? How does argumentative theory work? And if somebody doesn't have an argument and they're just lying, they will resort to violence. It always goes that way. This has been taking place since the fall. There's been deception since the fall and during the fall. Satan came to Eve and questioned God's word. And she took the bait. She bit it. The deception was there, and she took it. And that's what's happening to the Muslims. In recent years, their age-old animosity towards the Jews has just gotten accelerated. They won't be reasonable to talk about these things. They simply will use specious arguments or obfuscation or any way that they can to avoid talking about the truth. They're confused. They are absolutely confused. Those that have accepted this and those that promote it, if they're not confused, then they're seditious. They're just liars, and they're so far outside of the truth that they're intentionally trying to deceive and harm the world. Now, we know that 1 Corinthians 14:33 said that God is not the author of confusion, but of peace. Therefore, if they're confused, they're not telling the truth, they know, or we know, that they're driven satanically. This is a way that the adversary can get his agenda promoted. Muhammad presented himself in the 7th century as a shaman. Shaman, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. It depends on who's saying it. He claimed to have control over the jinns, the spirit world, and the animals and plants and whatnot. When he was converted, he converted them on the road back to Mecca from Taif. And this is always going to be the situation when you're dealing with Muslims. And it's something that we have to be aware of because they have a strong propensity to violence. And all they will do is listen to what you say and then start screaming and yelling and fighting and say it's not true, and they'll fight back any way they can. There's no such thing as a fair fight. In a fair fight, you lose. That's all. You just lose. These guys don't fight fair. They will bomb your house. They'll kill your kids. They'll do whatever they can to get their point of view pushed through. And once they've intimidated, you just look at the gangsters in the 1920s and 1930s, the bootlegger, did the same thing. These guys would come around and they'd say, we're going to charge for protection. What do you mean protection? I don't need any protection. Well, yes, you do. Well, your store's going to get burned. Your family's going to get killed. Well, man, I don't want that to happen. Well, then you pay me some money and I'll make sure it doesn't happen. So the crime gets quieted down because people are afraid, and that's what happens. The violence causes people to be afraid. There's this mythological view of Muhammad that history has been rewritten, and if anybody tries to contradict this, they resort to violence. There's been a ton of instances in our lifetime where we've seen this. And I just cited one here tonight that in September of 2005, a Danish cartoonist published 12 cartoons, 9 of which were innocuous, 3 presented Muhammad in an unfavorable light. But none of them were just horrible. None of them were horrible. The newspaper was the Jyllands Posten, and they published this because they wanted to get this debate over censorship and or promulgation of Islam. Let's not have this censorship from the Islamists trying to stop this stuff going out. Well, within 4 months, the Muslims protested across the Islamic world, and most of the protests were violent in some way or another. They bombed the Danish embassy in Pakistan. They set fire to the Danish embassies in Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. And they stormed European buildings. They burned the Danish, Dutch, Norwegian, French, and German flags in Gaza City. We've seen these things on the television where they're all screaming and yelling and they're running around and they're burning people in effigy and so on. And various groups, though, that was interesting, back in 2005 and early 2006, a whole bunch of groups responded by endorsing what the Danish folks did. So there was an international outcry. We're not seeing that much today, not with the folks that we have in power today, especially in the United States. And there were some campaigns that said, buy Danish and support the Danish folks. The Danish Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, he described the controversy as Denmark's worst controversy since World War II. Worst crisis, worst international crisis since World War II. And the Muslims' reaction, though, is typical. That's what they do. You can see this happening at universities. Somebody teaches a class on Islam. They'll come in the class and they'll scream and they'll yell. They'll try and shut it down. You can quote their sources, and they just have this ideological, mythological view. Well, Muhammad was sinless. He couldn't say those things. Well, yeah, but it's in your Quran. Well, the Quran is sinless. The Quran is pure, came from God, so it couldn't say that. Well, it does. It says it right here. No, it doesn't. There's no logic to it. When somebody wants to kill and harm, logic and reason don't work at all. They just don't work. There was a Christian apologist, I'm sure he's still out there, that he lived close to me in California, and he'd go out on the college campuses, and he would talk to kids about Christ and get in debates with them about the facts and truth of Christianity. His name is Josh McDowell. And he basically started lessening the amount of time that he spent doing this because he said, I just saw this general nature in the universities of people not wanting to hear and not wanting to engage in logic and reasonable discussion. I'm going to believe what I want to believe. I don't care what you say. I don't care if it's even true. I was talking one day that I was listening to him. He was saying to some guy that he was witnessing to, he said, you know, I've been talking to you for months now, and I presented tons of factual data. How much data do you need before you believe that Christ is exactly who he said he was? He said, oh, I'll never believe it. I don't care what you give me. He said, but I've given you all these facts. Yeah, I know. I'm still not going to believe it. I don't care. It's like the prince of this world has blinded these people so much that they're not willing to even look at a fact. They're not willing to look at facts, and nowhere in this world is it worse than within Islam. Now, let's talk about a few of his characteristics. He was a very greedy person. One clear example of the greed and murder is found in his biography. And because of his greed, he murdered a man named Kiana. And this guy refused to give up his treasure. And the count, I'm going to read it just verbatim here. Kiana al-Rabi, who had custody of the treasure of Banu Nadir, was brought to the apostle who asked him about it. He denied that he knew where it was. A Jew came, Tabari says, was brought to the apostle and said that he had seen Kiana going around a certain ruin every morning. When the apostle said to Kiana, do you know that if we find you, I shall have to kill you? He said, yes. The apostle gave orders that the ruin was to be excavated and some of the treasure was found. When he asked him about the rest, he refused to produce it. So the apostle gave orders to Al-Zubayr and Al-Awam, torture him till you extract what he has. So he kindled a fire with flint and steel on his chest until it was nearly dead. Then the apostle delivered him to Muhammad B. Maslama, and he struck off his head in revenge for his brother Muhammad. This is from the life of Muhammad. This is from his, you know, his biography. Now, Muhammad taught that it was lawful for him to steal people's possession after war. You can steal anything you want. This is a hadith. It's S81. Pickthall. All the hadiths and the Quran surahs have names associated with the particular number. Ask thee, O Muhammad, of the spoils of war. Say, the spoils of war belong to Allah and a messenger. So keep your duty to Allah and adjust the matter of your difference and obey Allah and his messenger if ye are true believers. What he's saying is, you just give me your money. You just give me whatever. If you guys are true believers, you got to give it all to me. That belongs to me. He's not talking about just general spoils of war. He's talking about, I want it all. His wealth increased significantly because of this dealing. Now, he made a lot of money in business opportunities at the Kaaba and with his first wife, but man, he got a ton of money from thievery and stealing. A guy named Abu Huraira, who was a companion of Muhammad and a narrator of some of the hadith, said, whenever a dead man in debt was brought to Allah's apostle, he would ask, has he left anything to repay his debt? If he was informed that he had left something to repay his debts, he would offer his funeral prayer. Otherwise, he'd tell the Muslims to offer their friend's funeral prayer. When Allah made the Prophet wealthy through conquest, he said, I am more rightful than other believers to be the guardian of the believers. So if a Muslim dies while in debt, I am responsible for the repayment of his debt, and whoever leaves his wealth after his debt, it will belong to his heirs. Well, he was the heir. He's the heir. In other words, it all comes to me, and I'll do with it as I please. If I want to pay somebody's debt that dies, I will or I won't, but I want all the money. I want all the money. I want to dispense with it. And he permitted lying when it was employed to help with a murder. Another guy, Jabir bin Abdullah, says, Allah's apostle said, who is willing to kill Ka'b bin al-Shraf, who has hurt Allah and his apostle? Thereupon, Muhammad bin Maslama got up saying, O Allah's apostle, would you like that I kill him? The Prophet said, yes, Muhammad bin Maslama said, then allow me to say a false thing, that is to deceive Ka'b. The Prophet said, you may say it. So, it's okay to lie. Just go ahead. You know, we're going to kill that guy anyway, so it's okay. He sanctioned lying so that Maslama could deceive the guy he was going to kill and then kill him. He was a polygamous, sexual, deviant person. He had a huge weakness for women and sex. One of the Islamic authors, Ali Dashti, commented, all the commentaries agree that verse 57 of Surah 4, which is called An-Nisa, was sent down after the Jews criticized Muhammad's appetite for women, alleging that he had nothing to do except take wives. So, you know, we've got quotes from other people talking about what the Bible, or not Bible, excuse me, what the Quran says about these things. Robert Morey, again in his book, he offers the following. He says, Muhammad's polygamy is not the only issue. It also poses a big legal and logical problem for the Muslims. Because the Quran in Surah 4:3 forbids the taking of more than four wives, to have any more would have been sinful for Muhammad. And Morey writes, one Muslim apologist with whom I was conversing argued as follows. Well, Muhammad was sinless. The Quran makes taking more than four wives a sin. Well, therefore, Muhammad could not have taken more than four wives. Why? Well, because Muhammad was sinless. It's this crazy circular reason that has no logic. So Morey says, I pointed out the question of how many wives Muhammad or anyone else had should be answered on the basis of the historical and literary evidence and not blind faith. Muslim scholar and statesman Ali Dashti, these guys that I'm quoting now are from a previous generation. They're telling what actually happened. These aren't contemporary guys. Ali Dashti gives the following list of women in Muhammad's life. Now, I'm not going to run through them now because there's 22 women. And Khadijah was the first one. He married when she was 40 and he was 25. And she's the one that really pushed him into Islam. And Sauda and Aisha. And I want to talk about those two for a moment. The first 16 of these wives were actual wives. The first 16 of these women were actually wives. Number 17 and 18 were slaves or concubines. And the last four were devout Muslim women that threw themselves at him. And they just wanted to satisfy his sexual desires. The Quran states that he was a messenger. It never says that he was a prophet, that he came from God, that he was godlike. As a matter of fact, one of the surahs said, I am only a human like you. He never claimed to be a god. He never claimed to be holy, but people developed this after, many, many years after. Burnham al-Din al-Halabi was one of the Muslims' greatest 16th century scholars. So about the time of the Reformation, this guy was writing, and he said, if Muhammad had an unmarried woman, he has the right to enter into her without the ceremony of marriage and without any witnesses or guardians. Not even her consent was necessary. But if the woman was married, Muhammad expressed his desires towards her, it becomes a must for her husband to divorce her so that Muhammad could marry her. Also, Muhammad had the right to give that woman in marriage to any man without her consent. He could even get married during the seasonal pilgrimage, as he did with Maimuna. He also had the right to choose of the captives whomever he wanted before the distribution of the spoils of the wars. Now, we saw that he married his first wife, and during the time he was married to her, he, at least it's recorded, we don't know what he did, but he didn't have any other sexual relationships that have been recorded or discussed. And after she died, he married two women. And the first one was Swada, and the second one was Aisha. And the Islamic data shows that he married Aisha at the age of 6 years old. And there are gobs of quotes about this. The Muslims today are trying to backpedal on this as hard as they can. They're trying to say that, well, the numbers were probably inaccurate. She's probably like 16, not 6. And besides, the culture was different then. I mean, they're doing everything they can to backpedal away from this stuff. But Sahih al-Bukhari, he relates the following quote from Aisha. She's been recorded. The Prophet engaged me when I was a girl of 6 years. We went to Medina and stayed at the home of Bani al-Harith bin Kahrazi. Then I got ill and my hair fell down. In other words, it fell out. Later on, my hair grew again, and my mother, Ruman, came to me while I was playing in a swing with some of my girlfriends. She called me, and I went to her, not knowing what she wanted me to do. She caught me by the hand and made me stand at the door of the house. I was breathless then, and when my breathing became all right, she took some water and rubbed my face and head with it. Then she took me into the house. There in the house, I saw some Ansari women who said, best wishes and Allah's blessing and a good luck. Then she entrusted me to them, and they prepared me for the marriage. Unexpectedly, Allah's apostle came to me in the forenoon, and my mother handed me over to him, and at that time I was a girl of 9 years of age. Ibn Ishaq, his biographer, his earliest biographer, says he married Aisha in Mecca when she was a child of 7 and lived with her in Medina when she was 9 or 10. She was the only virgin that he ever married. There's a whole ton of sources that affirm this, that he married her around the age of 6 or 7. And he consummated the marriage when she was 9. I mean, he had intercourse with her. She was 9. He was roughly 54, 55 years old, and he could have been her great-grandfather. And he married her. She's the only virgin that he ever married, and according to many accounts, that was his favorite wife. He also is recorded in many, many instances as having eyes for an infant girl, an infant, promising to marry her when she grows. Ibn Ishaq places this event during the time of the Battle of Badr, which is about 624 AD, when Muhammad was roughly 54 years old, the time he married Aisha. These sexual activities that took place then, even though some of the Muslim apologists today are saying that's not accurate, that's not true, they can't cover it up completely. And what we see happening today is the way they act speaks a whole lot louder than their words. You know them by their fruit. You know people by what they do rather than by what they say. People can say all kinds of things, but watch what they do. how do they live their lives? Well, the Muslims live their lives according to their supposed prophet. I don't know if you remember this, but the first leader of Iran after the Shah fell was Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, and he wrote extensively on Islamic jurisprudence. He wrote a two-volume book, that was called Tahrir al-Wasila. It was translated into Farsi, and I think this was like 1990 or so. And he had several other books that he wrote. One is on the Islamic rules for living. It was called in English The Little Green Book. He was interviewed by two girly magazines in 1979 and 80, Playboy and I think the other one was called Penthouse. And these things were published in those magazines. So this stuff is out there, plus his books. You can still buy his books. And this is what he says. A man can have sexual pleasure from a child as young as a baby. However, he should not penetrate vaginally, but sodomizing the child is acceptable. If a man does penetrate and damage the child, then he should be responsible for her subsistence all her life. This girl will not count as one of his four permanent wives, and the man will not be eligible to marry the girl's sister. It is better for a girl to marry at such a time when she would begin menstruation for her husband's house rather than for her father's home. Any father marrying his daughter so young will have a permanent place in heaven. A man can have sex with animals, such as sheep, cows, camels, and so on. However, he should kill the animal after he has his orgasm. He should not sell the meat to the people in his own village, but selling the meat to a neighboring village is reasonable. If one commits an act of sodomy with a cow, a ewe, or a camel, their urine and their excrement become impure, and even their milk may no longer be consummated. The animal must then be killed as quickly as possible and burned. This is what they teach. This is what they teach, and this is what these guys today deny. The Council on Islamic Relations, Karen or whatever they are, all these guys are, oh, that's not true. Oh, he's just one isolated case. No, he's not. He's not. You have to understand what Islam is. It's sick, it's satanically driven, and it's completely outside of Christ's will.